The headlines: Iran says it will definitely avenge the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as the country marks the third anniversary of its retaliatory missile strike on a major American airbase. Thousands of people rally against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, holding banners reading "Together Against Fascism." And China lifts quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years following last month's decision to end a zero COVID policy. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A top Iranian military commander has reiterated Tehran's resolve to take revenge on those responsible for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. The chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says this will be done sooner or later, and the perpetrators will be brought to justice. Hossein Salami hailed General Soleimani, saying the late commander was at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. The IRGC chief said Soleimani rendered the enemy's plots ineffective. Salami also hailed the massive participation of Iranians in General Soleimani's funeral. And as we've told you, today marks the third anniversary of Iran's ballistic missile attack against the U.S. Ain al-Assad airbase in Iraq's western province of Al-Anbar. The raid was carried out in retaliation for the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps unleashed more than a dozen ballistic missiles on the base. It caused significant damage, while the Pentagon said more than 100 American forces suffered traumatic brain injuries. The attack in January 2020 was the largest of its kind in modern history. Iran called it a first slap in the face of the U.S. and vowed harsher revenge in the future. The missile strike came as Iran laid to rest General Soleimani, who, along with his comrades, was killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad airport. Soleimani played a pivotal role in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. And thousands of demonstrators have gathered in Tel Aviv to protest against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet. The protesters held banners that read "Together Against Fascism" and "Apartheid and Crime Minister." The protesters also denounced judicial reforms proposed by the new justice minister. Opposition parties say the proposed judicial reforms allow parliament to override decisions of the Supreme Court. Netanyahu, who is fighting corruption charges, took office late last month, and his new cabinet is regarded as the most right-wing in Israeli history. To discuss that further, we're joined by Muti Abu Musaibeh, Palestinian political activist. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us. Now, the question is, it's interesting for us looking from outside to see that this proposed cabinet is so right-wing, it has caused protests inside Israel.
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. Today the recent formed Israeli government actually reveals the real political deadlock the Israeli occupation is experiencing. And this actually refers to many reasons. First of all, we have a prime minister who is charged of many corruption cases and charges. In addition to the cabinet and the ministers, who are 70% of them affiliated to the far right wing extremist, which means that we are in front of a new government which is driven and led by the far right wing, which means that more and more crimes yet to be committed against the Palestinian people specifically. And actually, it also deepens the situation inside the Israeli community itself, because that kind of racism practiced by this government will actually has its reflections and consequences on the Israeli community itself, which actually led the Israeli community and the Israeli settlers to demonstrate and to take to the streets in order to demonstrate against such a government. Furthermore, this government actually represents an unprecedented situation regarding the political attitude of the Israeli government, which actually would have a lot of consequences and ramifications on the regional situation, especially regarding the neighbor countries, such as Syria, Egypt, Iran, and etc. So we are in front of an unprecedented Israeli government, which actually, from the first beginning, tends to have more offensive policies towards the Palestinian people. They have a lot of racist laws and a lot of offensive laws and rules in order to be passed by the Knesset and passed by the cabinet. So I think such a government is intended to have more and more offenses against the Palestinian people and against many parties.
So, Mr. Mousabeh, as you mentioned so yourself, we have been witnessing an escalation in Israeli crimes and atrocities against Palestinians. And, of course, today we also received news that three officials, Fatah officials, were revoked their permits to enter occupied territories. How do you think the landscape will change for Palestinians?
Yes, no one can deny that when it comes to the Palestinian people, whether the Israeli government was from the right wing or the left wing, the Israeli crimes against Palestinians are continued and persist. But it seems that, and it's obvious actually, that this kind and the trajectory of those crimes committed and perpetrated against the Palestinian people are going to continue and to increase actually. With this government, which is totally affiliated to the right-wing extremists. Having this government means more crimes are yet to be committed, more settlements are yet to be built, more Palestinian lands are yet to be stolen and confiscated. So when it comes to the Palestinian people, I think this government would exaggerate and exacerbate the suffering of the Palestinian people. And I would like to remind you that the last year, 2022, the Israeli occupation forces killed more than 230 Palestinian people, which actually represents the highest number of the Palestinians who were killed by the Israeli forces since 2005 so far. This number is expected to rise with this government, which actually denies any kind of the Palestinians' right of having a sovereign state or having the right of self-determination or having even the right of existence on the Palestinian land. So this is the real meaning of having this extremist government led by the corrupt Benjamin Netanyahu.
Thank you very much. That was Moti Abu Mousabeh, Palestinian political activist, joining us live from Gaza. Moving on, the UAE ambassador to the UN accuses certain states of politicizing the Syrian chemical weapons file. Lana Zaki has severely criticized the attempts made by certain countries to politicize the Syrian chemical weapons case. She asks all parties in the Security Council to professionally consider the matter in line with the non-politicization of policy of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Despite Abu Dhabi's role in instigating the Syrian conflict by supporting foreign-backed militants and spread of misinformation, the Emirati government has recently adopted a diplomatic approach to normalize ties with Damascus. The Western media and governments have repeatedly alleged that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own citizens in the war against terrorists, and that is while Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons in 2014 to a joint mission led by the United States and the OPCW. Meanwhile, China has officially ended its quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years, despite struggling with a nationwide surge of COVID cases. All travelers are still required to test negative for COVID-19 within 48 hours of departure. Mainland China has also opened its borders to Hong Kong. Beijing has begun a dramatic dismantling of hardline zero COVID strategy that involved mandatory quarantines and ruling lockdowns. This containment policy had generated resentment throughout China and led to nationwide protests just before it eased. The UK Prime Minister has called for radical actions to reform Britain's crisis-hit healthcare system. Rishi Sunak made the remarks in an emergency meeting with British health leaders. He said bold moves should be taken, like the ones during the COVID pandemic, to resolve the crisis. The meeting comes as the UK is witnessing a rare strike by health workers who want a salary hike at the time when inflation has soared to record levels in the country. Britain has faced a wave of industrial action over the last few months, with strikes crippling various sectors of the government, which is planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. We're joined by our correspondent Amina Taylor, live from London. Amina, tell us more about this recent initiative of the government. Now, they are planning to create more obstacles in the way of those who want to strike. What does this exactly entail?
Well, that's a very important point you bring up there, Gisu. And please, let's remember, this is the very same government, albeit headed by a different leader, who stood on the front of Downing Street, on the front of their homes, in their constituencies, and urged the country to clap for our key workers who were risking life and limb in order to get us through the pandemic. And now, instead of sitting at the table, negotiating with good intent, in good faith, you're now looking at ways in which health workers, key workers, it will make it more difficult for them to strike. That smacks me as the very height of not just a level of callousness and cruelty, but a level of hypocrisy. Because these are MPs, members of parliament, who go back year after year and ask for a price hike in terms of their salary range, which is well over £85,000, because inflation has gone up. And here we are with record levels of inflation, with health workers, especially nurses, saying, listen, in essence, what you're offering us is a huge pay cut, because wages have fallen since the government took over, since the different incarnations of the Conservatives since 2010. They're actually experiencing a wage decrease. Unless you put that up in the region of 19%, it's a pay cut. So why would nurses, why would other key workers think this is okay? And for Rishi Sunak, a man who, well, let's be frank, has had more luck in the job than his predecessor, who lasted 44 days, there was a level of goodwill toward Rishi Sunak. Like, let's hear what he has to say. Let's give him an opportunity to address this issue head on. And the strategies that have so far emerged from him and his office have been disappointed. Frankly, they've been hugely disappointing and disrespectful to the very people who kept this country running, kept this country going through the health crisis.
So, Amina, you brought up the name of Rishi Sunak, and he has said that we should take drastic measures the way we did during the COVID pandemic. I'm quoting him. So what drastic measures does he mean?
Well, I think he's holding out a little hope, because remember, he was the chancellor who brought us the furlough scheme. And that was a way of propping up businesses and individuals who would have otherwise become either unemployed or their employers would have had to cut back, causing even more pressure on government resources and the Treasury's coffers. So I'm really hoping here, what he's trying to say is, listen, we might have to do a one-off bold initiative to make something happen, to move this logjam. But in the very same breath, if you're going to talk about making it more difficult to strike, when it's already difficult to strike, remember, you have to ballot your members. You have to get over a certain percentage here to go forward with any kind of ballot plans. And already ingrained in the charter of paramedics and health workers is the fact that you can't turn down life-saving treatment for a strike. So we had many cases of health workers walking off the picket because their colleagues needed them in a code red situation. So the idea that it's easy peasy to strike is a misnomer. So I sincerely hope that the benefit of the doubt I'm giving Rishi Sunak to try and move this logjam forward with maybe a one-off inflation busting payment or something to that effect. But so far I've not seen those signs been kind of moving in the direction of travel that I'd like to see. So, and I think a lot of health workers, especially those who still have strike action on the table for next week and going forward into the new year, might get some better news from the Prime Minister, who so far, in terms of Tory leaders, is having a little bit of a honeymoon period. Let's see if he can keep that going with some firm action to support the very workers who kept this country afloat.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Amina Taylor, live from London. Now, one person is killed after Russia resumes bombing of eastern Ukrainian regions, ending a self-declared ceasefire along the front line that lasted 36 hours. The death was from shelling that hit the northern region of Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials also reported explosions across the border with Donbass, which has been the front line for months. The truce was announced by Moscow for Orthodox Christmas celebrations that fell on Saturday, but Kiev rejected the ceasefire. The Kremlin now says that Moscow will push ahead with the war until victory is achieved. Colombia's relations with neighboring Venezuela has improved under the country's first-ever leftist president. In the latest sign, Gustavo Petro has traveled to Venezuela to meet his counterpart Nicolas Maduro. It is the leader's second meeting since Petro took power from Iván Duque last August and the official resumption of diplomatic ties a month later. The trip also comes just days after the final reopening of the South American neighbor's shared border that was closed for years. Venezuela severed diplomatic relations with its neighbor in 2019. This happened after Bogota backed Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido as the interim government. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just
but
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless. So.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. Military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation. against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life for IRIB English Radio. I am Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol, and one of my specialties is in enhancing the style for living. And my talk is based on the Quran and Islamic tradition. In this episode of the program, I will be going over a fact with regard to having a better knowledge about the real essence of our life. The fact is that when we are born, our life in this world begins, okay? But as soon as we start to know different things, know the environment and understand objects, understand people, and so on. As we gain the power to analyze various things and differentiate between good and bad, gradually we realize, this is the point, we realize that we are going to face many struggles. We realize that there are many unwanted situations. There are many predicaments that we need to find a solution for them, and so on and so forth. Life could not be totally easy. Of course, life is full of beauty, full of good and enjoyable things. For example, calmness and tranquility. I don't want to ignore them, but I just want to point that we should not neglect that hardship is in its turn, or an unwanted situations are an inseparable part of our life. As much as we strive to solve these problems, we only can decrease the degree of these difficulties, and never we can wipe them totally out. Why I say that? Because sometimes we think that there are an achievement and a goal that we think we can have it. It is reachable. If we imagine that a specific goal is reachable, we try our best to have it. We try to gain it. But if we realize that some specific goals are not accessible at all, or are not reachable completely, or we can only have a portion of that goal, then we, instead of spending all of our energy on getting that, and then beat ourselves up for not having it, blaming ourselves and becoming disappointed instead of it, can easily do what we think that we should do or we could do, and then sit back calmly and accept our destiny. As a result, as I said, when the real essence of this world is that hardship is an inseparable part of our life, if we get stuck in an unsolvable entanglement, we should never become angry in gratitude to Allah or even disappointed. Let me here refer to one of the noble sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says in this regard, وَعْلَمْ بِأَنَّ الدَّهْرَ يَوْمَانِ. Know that the world has two different days. يَوْمٌ لَكَ وَيَوْمٌ عَلَيْكَ. One for you and for your benefit, and the other one is against you. وَأَنَّ الدُّنْيَا دَالُ دُوَلٍ. And that the world is a house of changing authorities. فَمَا كَانَ مِنْهَا لَكَ أَتَاكَ عَلَى ضَعْفِكَ. Whatever in it that is for your benefit, it will come to you despite your weakness. وَمَا كَانَ مِنْهَا عَلَيْكَ لَمْ تَدْفَعْهُ بِقُوَّتِكَ. And on the opposite, whatever of the days that are against you, you cannot push it away despite your strength and power. It means that if there is a day that is destined by Allah to be against us, as much as we try our best and as much as we use our power and might, we cannot escape from it. Let's have a break for a short time, and I will be back in a minute.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We were talking about the real essence of this world so as to adjust ourselves with it more easily. As we understood from the mentioned hadith of Imam Ali, we always face two different versions of life, a good one, an unpleasable one. Sometimes we are destined to face the beauty side of the world, of our life. So even if we are weak or even be unaware at all, that beauty enters in our life and makes us happy, makes us joyful. But totally contrary, if we are doomed to encounter with the bad version of life, it will also come into our life regardless how powerful, strong, and mighty we are. This is the fact. Because of it, for example, we see that sometimes out of nowhere, someone may give us money. This is the beauty side of our life. A company may call us and offer us a job with a high income. Or for example, we may win in a competition and may will gain fame. On the other hand, if there comes a day that is against us, we may suddenly realize that, for example, someone whom we love so much passed away. Or maybe we lost a good fortune, we fail in an exam, or we may lose a game in a competition. For sure, paying attention to this reality of life can be very soothing. It is really relieving. It gives man great peace and it reduces the bitterness of failure. Because by this attitude and vision, if we face failure, we know that this is a part of everyone's life in this world. No one is always the winner, always successful, always happy or healthy. Let me add to it that usually when we face a failure, we lose hope because we think that we are unlucky or misfortunate. But if we realize that we are not the only one who faces the failure, if we realize that everyone in this world are like us, this helps us not to lose heart because we see that all people like us, we are in the same boat. Of course, what I mean is not that we do not try to have a better life, do not try to reduce the pain of so-called unpleasant phase of life, not at all. Rather, we have to try our best to find success, to be triumphant or to be victorious. But beside it, should be aware that we cannot control everything, cannot change the life into a 100% degree in harmony with our desires. Add to it that if we are knocked down in our life, let's use this terminology, it will give us more experience. We can check our strong points and weaknesses and try to work on our strong points and become stronger, and also pay attention to our weak points and try to compensate. This is the positive side and of analyzing the situations. Now let me end my discussion by this gold fact. The world is under the management of Allah, under the supervision of Allah, and Allah is the supervisor of all of our affairs, and nothing of happiness and hardship is without wisdom, and we have to try to find the wisdom behind every action that we face in our life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash. I share, he knows. Allah knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.